Hey, gang. Welcome to another exciting episode of National People Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, the last republic you have left. So show some support for free speech. Go to republicbroadcasting.org, click on the donate button, and send a donation. If you send $100 or more, you get a free speech t-shirt. It's not a free t-shirt because you're paying, but it is a free speech t-shirt, which is even better. And then go to nationalpeople.com. It is the home of the Koshertified app. You can click on that link. You can download the Koshertified app. You can lead a non-kosher certified lifestyle. You can take control of your own food consumption and ultimately your own life and society. Today, we have with us Don Advo from Stormfront Radio. Don Advo, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Great to be on.
So we did a talk about Brown versus the Board of Education back in 2016, when National People Radio was a YouTube podcast, and I have replayed it once or twice since joining RBN, but we'll be talking about that. But I was on Friday, a few days ago, I was listening to the America First Political Action Committee speech, the keynote speech made by Nick Fuentes, who's a kid. He's a kid. He's 22 years old, but he's doing a lot better than I was doing when I was 22. He's got a big movement going of young people. He does talk openly about Jewish power, which is a big deal, and yet was able to get former Representative Steve King and current Representative Paul Gosar, I think that's his name, to attend this conference along with Michelle Malkin. So he got some pretty mainstream people to attend this conference in Washington, Orlando, I guess it was. It was a rival to the CPAC conference. It was at the same weekend, same city. And in it, now he didn't quote you by name, but he quoted you. He used your idea. He was in his keynote speech, he was saying that there is a racial caste system. That's the word he used. And when I heard him use that, he said a racial caste system with whites on the bottom. And that wasn't just like some sort of throwaway phrase he was using. That was a key point he was making. And I thought, I've heard that before. So I called you up. And I mean, maybe somebody independently thought of that, but we'll play that right. We'll put it right here. But
and then finally, I want to talk about the issue of anti-white toxicity, as Michelle put it aptly, in the mainstream media. Specifically, I want to talk about it in the context of the Black Lives Matter riots last year. If anybody could look at what conservatives said last year in the wake of the George Floyd riots and not find it woefully insufficient at best, treacherous at worst, then you're probably in Black Lives Matter. Because the Republican response to cities being burned to the ground, the response to statues of our ancestors and heroes being torn down, the response to new holidays being created and old ones discarded, and the creation, and don't forget this, the creation of a new racial caste system in this country with whites at the bottom, if your reaction to all of that is to say, Black Lives Matter doesn't really care about black lives, if your reaction to all of that is to say, what does burning down Minneapolis do for black people in the south side of Chicago? If your response to that is to say that BLM is just too violent or not moderate enough, then you are a traitor to the United States of America.
You thought of that, right?
Yes, I did. It was original with me.
And, you know, that's the thing. We're older, and we've been working hard, and it's not necessary. You know, it would be nice to have glory. It would be nice to have recognition. But I tell you one thing, it's a lot better to have one's ideas be grabbed on by the up-and-coming generation than to have them just disappear into the ether. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I think it's better if good ideas survive instead of disappearing.
And, yeah.
I was very heartened when you gave me the link to that Nick Fuentes speech and saw him use that term. It's a very specific term, I think a very descriptive and a very appropriate term.
Yeah, and that's what we've got. But, you wonder because here we are almost 70 years after Brown versus the Board of Education, that landmark decision by the Supreme Court that ended school segregation and created a big, happy, race-blind society, aren't we all so much better off for it?
No, we're not.
Is anybody better off for it?
I don't know any white people who had the experience of going to racially integrated schools who think they were better off for it. I know a hell of a lot of them who think they were much worse off for it, including some fairly famous people like Howard Stern, mm-hmm. who said that when he went to Roosevelt High School, racially integrated, he basically got beaten up every day by the blacks. There's an actor named Rob Lowe. I'm sure we've all... he's getting a little older now, but he was a very famous young actor. I read he wrote a book, he wrote a memoir, and in there he talked about his stepfather was a liberal who loved everybody, and he and his mother moved to a racially integrated school, and he said his main task every day was to keep from getting his ass kicked by the blacks. Mm-hmm. Dana Perino, who was a White House press director. And public now, face of the Fox George News W. Person. Bush administration. Now you see her on Fox News. She wrote a memoir, and in one of her interviews, she talked very forthrightly and candidly about how going to school, I think it was in Denver, Colorado, to a racially integrated school elementary school, basically ruined her life for several years. So traumatic was the experience. So no, racial integration has not worked out. White people continue to flee cities. Los Angeles, the Los Angeles public schools are like 85% non-white now. So white people have been, for all practical purposes, completely ethnically cleansed mm-hmm. from the Los Angeles public school system. Mm-hmm. If you read the Los Angeles Times, which is owned by a Chinaman, not even an American citizen anymore, you can see white people have largely been ethnically cleansed from the pages of the Los Angeles Times. It's very mm-hmm. rare to find a picture of a white person, mm-hmm. so, unless it's Joe Biden, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, that makes me feel better. So there was a political pollster and strategist named Arthur Finkelstein, who he helped a lot of Republicans get elected in the 70s and 80s. And in the 1990s, he went over to Israel and helped Benjamin Netanyahu win his first national election with the phrase, "He's good for the Jews." That was the catchphrase. The slogan was, "He's good for the Jews."
Right.
And of course, the Jews can ask, "Is it good for the Jews?" I know we're not allowed to ask, is it good for white people? Although why not? We should be able to ask if it's good for white people. But I think you've already answered that. Just out of curiosity, do you think Brown versus Education Board of the Education was even good for the black people?
I don't know if it was good for them or not. It doesn't seem to have improved their performance in school very much. It seems to be a kind of like a magnifying glass. You know how it focuses the sun's beam? And I think some of us, when we were young, we took a magnifying glass and we focused the rays of the sun to burn a hole in a piece of paper or to melt down ants or something. And it seems to be a device that focuses and concentrates black hatred of white people. That's one of the things you see. You see these black civil rights lawyers, and there was a black chief justice on this, or black Associate Justice on the United States Supreme Court, Thurgood Marshall, who wrote all these opinions, and the
and
obsession.
Hadn't he been one of the lawyers in the Brown case, Brown versus?
I believe he was. Yeah, yeah, he was a lawyer in the Brown case, and their whole career is talking about how to humiliate white people and reduce white people in legal status, and to deny white people equal protection of the law. There's not much emphasis on studying harder or looking up unfamiliar words in the dictionary or really doing anything to improve themselves. They always define freedom and progress in terms of being able to establish possession of white children, at least in the educational context. Now, the interesting thing is they want to insert themselves to the fullest extent in the lower grades into white schools, and they want to attach themselves to white children. But that all changes in college. The emphasis there is not on having white classmates, but on trying to limit white enrollment in colleges to the fullest extent possible. And now you have in colleges, you have black student unions and separate black dormitories and even separate black graduations. And this is all spoken of with great approval.
Yeah, Harvard had a separate black graduation, as I recall.
A lot of schools are doing that. And you also have the phenomenon of historic black colleges. I heard Hillary Clinton running for public office, and she talked about doubling the amount of money to historically black colleges. I never heard of that before. I didn't think it was even legal after the Brown decision. But it is legal for blacks to have their own schools. It is legal. Now, they don't practice racial discrimination, but as a practical matter, what white person wants to go to a historically black college? Not very many people do. So blacks really don't need the protection of laws in that sense, because you don't see white people typically elbowing their way into, you know, the NAACP or typically into the black community.
Well, there was that one white lady who pretended to be black.
You get mentally ill white person.
Yeah, what was her name? Rachel Dolezal.
Rachel Dolezal or something like that.
Yeah. And that's probably kind of, honestly, I don't mean to be mean, but probably kind of a mental illness. But, you know, I'm not trying to encourage people defining the value of Brown versus Board of Education on what it did for black people. I mean, we should, like the Jews, we should be able to say, ask, is it good for the whites, and base opinions on that. But, you know, one thing it seems to do is, if blacks and whites are going to separate schools, blacks aren't exposed in such stark terms to how much poorly they do in, say, mathematics or a lot of other academic activities. And it would probably, what would it do to the ego? I don't know. What would it do to the ego of a black student to find themselves so far behind? Of course, the ones who find themselves the farthest behind probably care the least. I don't know.
Well, I don't know what their thinking is at all. I mean, you know, you have standardized tests and standardized textbooks, and you know, if you're not performing up to the standards, you study harder. And when I was a child, I went to school for a period of time in Canada in elementary school. I had a very difficult time there at first because they were very exacting, and the discipline was rather more in the content of quality of teaching, the quality of education, quite frankly, was better. There were higher expectations. Now, there were no blacks there, but there were different European types of people there, Canadian. It was all white, and I had a hard time. And, you know, my mother didn't lobby the school to lower the standards. My mother didn't go to the Canadian legislature, the parliament, or whatever they call it, and demand, you know, more money. My mother worked very hard with me at home, reading with me and getting me up to speed. So, you know, it's kind of a self-improvement type of thing. Your parents have to take some measure of responsibility. I wasn't particularly disturbed by the fact that I was performing in an a substandard way, but my parents, who after all were the adults, understood the importance of my working hard, and I did work hard. And then when we came back to the United States, I was considered to be, because I'd been performing in a higher level school system in Canada, I was considered to be gifted and a genius and, you know, all this kind of thing. So I don't know how gifted I am. I was just used to performing with different standards. And I don't see why blacks should be any less held responsible for studying harder than white people. But if you read the Brown decision, it doesn't talk about that at all. Neither do any of its progeny. Neither do any of the cases that came after Brown, some of which were really ugly and horrible. What is the evil of Brown, in my view? We talk about in the beginning of the show the use of the term a racial caste system. What is a racial caste system? Well, we know intuitively what it is, but there's a more specific legal term. If you study it, a racial caste system is a system in which certain preferred races are given greater protection of the law and certain disfavored races are given less protection of the law. And one of the places where white people are given less protection of the law is in the treatment of white children. Brown versus the Board of Education said you couldn't have racially segregated schools, even if schools were separate but equal, because racially segregated education was inherently unequal. And this is the actual legal holding in Brown. It's one sentence. I want to read it because it's very important. This is what the Brown court decided. This is the 1954 decision. We come to the question presented. Does segregation of children in public schools solely on the basis of race, even though the physical facilities and other tangible factors may be equal, deprive the children of the minority group of equal educational opportunities? We believe it does. Okay, think about what I just said. Okay, it says separate and apart from physical facilities and tangible factors, it is the separation of white children from minority children that deprives the minority child of a, quote, equal educational opportunity. See, it is not a good school. It is not good textbooks. It is not good teachers. It is not high standards that constitute the educational opportunity under Brown. Under Brown, it is the compelled physical presence of captive white children that constitutes the equal educational opportunity. And what Brown did was create a brand new constitutional right in the favor of minority groups, specifically said minority groups. That's not just blacks, that's browns and Asians and any other group you would care to mention. It doesn't say they have a right to an equal education. It doesn't say they have a right to a good education. It says you have a right to the compelled physical presence of unwilling white children, whether they want to be there or not. Well, there's a legal term for this. In the pre-Civil War era, it used to be called slavery. What you're dealing with here is a possessory right. They have a right to the possession of white children, whether white children want to be there or not. Indeed, it is specifically against the law, specifically unconstitutional, if white parents want to have their own separate white schools. Now, what is the basic meaning of all this? The basic meaning of this is that it is now illegal for white people to run away from black people. Because if white children run away from black children, that deprives the black children of an educational opportunity. Think back to before the Civil War. We had something called slavery. What was the purpose of slavery? The purpose of slavery was to stop black people from running away from white people. What did we call runaway black people? We didn't call it black flight. We called them fugitive slaves. Well, today, when white people run away from black people, they're not called fugitive white people. It's called white flight, which is considered to be a form of resistance to the legitimate moral and constitutional aspirations of black people. Remember that, what is slavery? Slavery is the compelled physical presence of unwilling persons. And its most fundamental meaning, slavery is a possessory interest, although certain types of slavery, such as we had in the United States, chattel slavery, involved something beyond possession. It involved ownership. When you owned a slave, you had not only the right to possess him, you had the right to pledge him as collateral, you had the right to sell him, you had the right to distribute him as part of your estate. So ownership goes beyond possession. You know, you buy a house, when you own the house free and clear, one of the elements of ownership is possession. But it's not the only element. And you can transfer the right to possession to a tenant. You can rent out the house.
And the tenant has possession but not ownership. Is that correct?
That's correct. And then if he doesn't pay the rent, you can evict him because your legally enforceable possessory interest arises there. We all understand this. You rent a car. You have a right to the possession of the car, but you have to give it back. And you finance a car. You know, you get possession of the car, but you don't get the title to the car until you pay off the loan. And if you don't make the car payments, the repo man comes around and repossesses the car. These are all concepts that are easily understood. They're easily understandable, whether you're talking about real property or personal property. Under slavery, slaves could be pledged as collateral, and they could be repossessed. A secured creditor could come in and take the slaves. Creditors of an estate could come in and take the slaves when the slave owner died. But, you know, since 1865, it's generally been illegal for people to have possessory interests in other people. You couldn't buy and sell human beings. You couldn't pledge human beings as collateral for loans. You couldn't foreclose on a human being and take possession of a human being. And if a parent today, if a parent said, I'm going to, you know, borrow money and I will pledge my child as collateral, and if I don't repay the loan, you can take possession of my child, he would be stripped of his parental rights and the child would be placed in foster care or transferred somewhere else.
Unlike Stormfront, RBN, we have some commercial breaks, and we're right up at a break, but we'll continue right after the break.
So you met someone who set you back on your heels. Goody, goody. So you met someone, and now you know how it feels. Goody, goody. So you gave him your heart too, just as I gave mine to you. And he broke it in little pieces, and now how do you...
Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now, but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Have you been looking for a trusted long-term storable food company? We have a solution for you. Simply Clean Foods is dedicated to providing the best quality food you can buy next to fresh from a farmer's market. Our line of resealable fruits, vegetables, and meats are suitable for everyday use, and you won't have to worry about throwing away valuable groceries ever again. Our food is completely GMO-free, and our stringent quality controls, plus testing for heavy metals, makes us unique in the storable foods market. Simply Clean Foods' primary focus is to bring clean food to people all around the world and change the way we look at freeze-dried food in our daily cooking. When you purchase from simplycleanfoods.net, not only will you be receiving high-quality food, but you will also be supporting veterans in need across the country and those who are affected by natural disasters. Right now, Amazon Prime members will receive fast two-day shipping. Go to simplycleanfoods.net. That's simplycleanfoods.net. But do it today.
Are back. So have you lost your train of thought, or do you remember what you
No, were? No, haven't lost it at all. Okay, all right. What I've done is a kind of a broad brush description of ownership and possessory interests as a form of ownership. Now, under slavery, the right to possess human beings was part of ownership. It was considered a form of ownership. Under the Brown decision, you have a legally enforceable possessory interest, not on the form of specific owners or specific persons, but on the form of one, the children of one race against the children of another race. So you have a form of legal possession without ownership. Now, minority children can't mortgage white children. They can't legally possess them. I mean, they can beat them up and steal their lunch money if they want to, but they can't legally pledge them as collateral. So what the Brown decision did in 1954, when it said that separating children was unconstitutional because it deprived minorities of an equal educational opportunity, was it vested in minority children a legally enforceable possessory interest. A possessory interest without the benefit of ownership, without the benefit of any of the other incidents of ownership, but a possessory interest nonetheless. Now, you have to understand where the separate but equal doctrine comes from. That comes from a case called Plessy versus Ferguson, decided in 1896, and that was based on a statute in Louisiana which required railroads to have separate racially segregated cars. And so they sued to say that this was unlawful under the Constitution, and the Supreme Court at that time said it was lawful as long as the facilities were separate but equal. And that was used as a justification for racially segregated schools and racially segregated, all kinds of racially segregated things. But what you have to understand about Plessy is it dealt with adults and it dealt with contractual relationships. You buy a ticket to ride on a railway car. Brown versus the Board of Education dealt with children, and the relationship between children and the public schools is not a contractual relationship. Children don't have the legal capacity to contract. Only adults do. What Brown did was create a possessory interest in people, and is the only form of legally enforceable possessory interest in human beings that I can conceive of or that I've run across in any kind of research. Now, in the cases that came after that, this kind of possessory interest is reaffirmed. In the aftermath of the Army marching into Little Rock, Arkansas, under the Insurrection Act against white parents, a number of southern states resisted compelled racial integration. And one of the cases was Green versus County School Board of New Kent County, Virginia. They had a situation where anybody could go to any school they wanted to go to, anywhere across town. The Supreme Court struck that down and said that did not compel the mandate of the Brown decision because it didn't force racial integration. It didn't force unwilling people together. It gave people freedom of choice, and that was inconsistent with the social engineering goals of the Brown decision. In 1971, the Swan decision was decided by the United States Supreme Court that said racial busing of students from one area to another area was constitutional. But I think a far more interesting case that gives us some insight into what the meaning of Brown is a case called Milliken versus Bradley that came out of Michigan, a United States Supreme Court case, 1974 case. And what happened is Detroit, Michigan, as most of us know, is a totally destroyed city because of the blacks have moved in and destroyed it. They had a mayor named Coleman Young, a black mayor. There was an enormous amount of racial rioting in the 60s, and very large areas of Detroit were destroyed by peaceful protesters, peaceful civil rights protesters, and a lot of white people just moved out. They fled, which is what most rational people would do. Well, they finally got a black mayor named Coleman Young, and he said, "I'm the MF-er in charge," only he used the full words, MF-er in charge, and if you don't like it, you know, white people, get out of town. Bottom line is white people were basically run out of Detroit. Well, of course, they moved to the suburbs. Mm-hmm. In white people, you had what's called white flight from the city. And in white flight from the city of Detroit led to increasingly minority urban areas and then white suburbs. And what the civil rights people in Milliken wanted to do was declare a multi-district kind of remedy where they could throw a net over the white suburbs and use those white children to reintegrate the Detroit schools. And
so have a school district that encompassed multiple municipalities, in other words?
Yeah, they were going to have the school district like an octopus a cancer cell reach out. And the Supreme Court said, you really can't do that. Let's do that in that case.
Unfortunately, we have one more break. We'll be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.com.
www.thewhitetrash.org.
Homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or sold your transaction to another lender or servicer, you may be the victim of a wrongful foreclosure resulting in the loss of your home. If you've already lost your home, are in foreclosure, or even in good standing, you can challenge the mortgage transaction's illegal issue and your property can be restored to you, and your foreclosure can be stopped or reversed and the mortgage transaction declared unenforceable. State laws, U.S. title codes, the Uniform Commercial Codes, and U.S. Supreme Court rulings have upheld that defective mortgage documentations can reverse or stop foreclosures and enforce property title claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2-KEEP-IT today.
The reviews for Extendivite are amazing. Amazon customer: it's amazing. I just ordered my second bottle. In 1 month, my blood pressure dropped significantly. I no longer get chest pain after I exercise. The reviews are spot on. My target is to get off of BP meds, and if it keeps going like this, I see a light at the end of the tunnel. Amazon customer: Extendivite works great. This product has made my blood pressure and cholesterol stable. I highly recommend it. Amazon customer: excellent herbal formula. I've been using it to keep my cardiovascular system fine-tuned. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com. That's HEARTDROP.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Hello, I'm Dr. Leonard Horowitz. I was right 30 years ago in warning the world about threatening lab virus outbreaks, AIDS, and Ebola. I was right 20 years ago when FBI Director Robert Mueller made me a suspect in the anthrax mailings because I warned the Bureau before the CIA's biocrime and Cipro sales psyops happened. I was right about COVID-19 being an AIDS-laced mutagen plan to resurge this fall to excuse officials' profitable depopulation globalization agendas. And I was right about the only safeguards being antioxidants and holy spiritual sustenance. Vitamin C, D, zinc, chlorophyll, oxygen, and oxysilver especially transmits the frequency resonance to neutralize the expanded function bioweapon. Oxysilver is a double superconductor of the healing power of love. It is the first nutraceutical invented to amplify prayer power and the faithful, loving intention of your heart. Buy, try, and stockpile OxySilver through HealthyWorldStore.com.
Is I here again? The skies above are clear again. Let us sing a song of cheer again. Happy days are here again. All together.
We are back. We're talking about Detroit, Michigan, and a Supreme Court case. Were the suburbs compelled to integrate or to combine their school districts with the largely black school district of Detroit?
No, Milliken versus Bradley held that they couldn't do that. They couldn't reach out like that. They had this idea that the white families in the suburbs should not be penalized through remedial remedies because they didn't have a history of segregation. And isn't it interesting that segregation integration is specifically referred to as form of punishment of white people. Thurgood Marshall, the first black justice on the Supreme Court, wrote a scathing dissent in this case, saying that the court's answer is to provide no remedy for the violation proved in this case, thereby guaranteeing that Negro children in Detroit will receive the same separate and inherently unequal education in the future as they have been unconstitutionally afforded in the past. Well, what is the violation? What is the violation that Thurgood Marshall talks about? The violation is white people ran away. White people ran away. And so the legally enforceable possessory rights of black people over white children in the Milliken case was thwarted, all to the great seething, raging anger of that great advocate of human equality, Thurgood Marshall.
I just have a question. Right, white people leave these black areas because blacks have a reputation for stealing and violence. And, you know, after last summer, how much looting and rioting do blacks have to do to dissuade white people of this false idea?
Well, I don't think it's a false idea. And the simple fact of the matter is most white people don't want to associate with blacks. They don't want to live in the same neighborhood or have their kids go to school with them for fairly obvious reasons.
Why is that?
Well, because there are irreconcilable conflicts of interest between two fundamentally different and biologically observably different types of people.
And a large part of that is violence and thievery, right?
Well, I think that's certainly part of it. But even separate and apart from that, I've never met any white people who has some burning desire to live next door to blacks or live around them. They're just different than we are, and we have a sense of. I mean, what is the premise of the Jewish state of Israel? The premise of the Jewish state of Israel is the right of the Jewish people to have their own country, their own community, their own identity. And nobody says you don't hear the NAACP screaming in Congress that foreign aid to the Jewish state of Israel should be eliminated because they don't have enough racial integration in the Jewish state of Israel. The rights of other people are routinely respected and exalted. They are exalted. The right to a separate identity, like the blacks have a right to their own black community. Remember, in the absence of racial segregation, in the absence of concentrations of black votes, people like Maxine Waters do not get elected. Mm-hmm. They do not get elected. Maxine Waters represents a black constituency in her district. Although Maxine Waters conveniently lives outside of her district in an all-white community called Hancock Park, where she lives in a $4 million mansion. Everybody has a right to live in a white neighborhood except white people. But that's the message I want to make on the Brown decision. The Brown decision is a very important part of the racial caste system because it reduced specifically Brown and the decisions that came after that recognized the legal status of white children as a form of property that can be possessed by non-whites. And I think the Brown decision and the whole argument behind that, equality and equal justice and equal education, is one of the most morally and intellectually challenging arguments to make, even though it's among the most dishonest. And there's a lack of understanding of what the Brown decision did, even among white activists. I mean, I remember reading about people who opposed the Brown decision. They said, well, it violated the holding in Plessy versus Ferguson, and that was controlling precedent and, you know, these technical legal arguments, which really have very little relevance to most people. My argument is, first of all, Plessy dealt with adults in contractual relationships. It didn't deal with children. Children are not adults. They don't have rights. They don't have freedom of association. They have to do what adults tell them to do. And the Brown decision reduced white children to the status of property. It's a weird status. It's a possessory interest without ownership, but it is a property interest nonetheless. It said, blacks have a right to force unwilling white children to sit next to them in classrooms and provide some sort of educational opportunity. God knows what that even really means, because if white children do better, that's white privilege. If white children do better, that's white racism. So the whole thing is morally and intellectually incomprehensible.
Okay, so
except in view of the perspective that I just outlined, mm-hmm. it's a form of establishing a racial caste system. Once you get through all the Orwellian double talk and double speak, it reduces white children to a subordinate level of citizenship in society.
Okay, so that's 1954, and then that's very early in the career of one Martin Luther King, who has become, in retrospect, one of our founding fathers, one of the founding fathers of our new Zygarchy of Wakanda, or whatever the new American country is going to be called. Now, aside from the fact that he had all sorts of very major personal faults, I mean, we could talk about them, but it's not just that. What he was, I mean, I'd like you to explain what he was really trying to achieve, what his actual goals were, aside from his failings as a person, what his goals were. Because were they just the type of goals that everybody can unite around and say, gosh, what a great man? Or did he have an agenda that when you actually dissect it, wasn't really so great for us?
Well, yeah, he had an agenda. The man was a communist. He was an outright Marxist. He believed in the basic principles of communism. He said that no amount of money can ever repay the Negro for what slavery did, but $50 billion would be a good start. Now, what does that really mean? Obviously, he's talking about the transfer of $50 billion, and this was in the 60s when billions of dollars was real money, not today when it's just, you know, pocket change. No amount of money can ever repay the Negro. Now, bear in mind, no existing black person was ever a slave, and no existing white person was ever a slave owner. So what this does is this says that the white race will be perpetually indebted to the black race. No amount of money can ever repay them. That means no amount of money can ever purchase white emancipation. And remember, under slavery, see, people say about Brown versus the Board of Education, well, you can opt out of racially segregated public schools by going to private schools. Yeah, if you've got the money. I mean, under slavery, blacks could opt out of slavery by purchasing their own freedom if they had the money or if somebody else had it. So that's really not much of an answer. But remember, under slavery, black people could buy their freedom. Under the civil rights regime outlined by Martin Luther King and other people like him, there's no amount of money that can ever purchase white freedom. We will forever be indentured to black people. And at one point in time, he said that America had a duty to uplift and support all of the poor people in the whole world. And if we didn't, we were destined to burn in hell. So what is the basic premise of Martin Luther King? The basic premise is a racial caste system, where one race is elevated to the superior status of a creditor race, that is black people, to whom this unpayable debt is owed. And you have another race, a subordinate race, and an inferior race, legally inferior race, if you will, white people who are a debtor race. The message of Martin Luther King is for a creditor race and a debtor race. Mm-hmm. It's no more complicated than that, and that is the whole purpose of the civil rights movement. I mean, giving blacks the legally enforceable possession of white children is just one dimension of it. Another dimension is the perpetual servitude of white people, the perpetual indebtedness that can never be paid to black people. So Martin Luther King advocated a racial caste system. He was a white hating communist, and I say that in a very literal sense. He believed that the wealth of white people should be liquidated and redistributed to the poor non-white peoples of the world. It's no more complicated than that. It's actually quite simple to understand what this monster advocated.
Now I have another question. So if you look around the world, the history of the 20th century or what's going on today, you see that where you've got minority groups, almost always you've got independence movements or separatist movements. So you think of in Burma a few years ago, the Rohingya were they were much talked about. In China, once it was the Tibetans some years ago. Now they're talking about the Uyghurs. But these are groups of people who want to go their own way. And that's typically it, except the civil rights movement, you did have people who weren't in the maybe the mainstream civil rights movement, but you had major black leaders from Marcus Garvey to Malcolm X who were not integrationists, they were separatists. To what extent do you think Martin Luther King's movement was kind of an aberration, was something that was astroturfed as opposed to being really grassroots?
God, that's a really great question. I've read a lot of slave narratives from that era, which first-person account by slaves or narratives by observers of slavery. And there was one book I read was a collection of narratives from slaves who got into Canada, and it was published in the 1850s by some Canadian abolitionist society or something. And they talked about how the blacks fled to Canada where they were beyond the reach of the fugitive slave laws. Mm-hmm. And when they got there, they were very productive, hardworking citizens. They had farms, they had communities. They were just wonderful people to have. But there was a recurring theme in the, and remember, this was published in the 1850s.
Mm-hmm.
The 1850s, and they talk about the importance of integrating white schools and integrating white churches in Canada. I mean, they had this weird obsession with attaching themselves as closely as they can to white people. Mm-hmm. And I read something very recently about Frederick Douglass. He was an escaped slave. He escaped, and then he went to the North and started a, in the 1850s, he started a newspaper in Rochester, New York, called the North Star. And he was a famous abolitionist and an orator and a publisher and all this kind of thing. And he spent his whole life talking about how badly black people got treated by white people in the United States. Well, he traveled to Ireland at one point, and he talked about how he was received so well and everybody loved him and there was no racial prejudice or anything, and how he loved that so much. And Douglass was a fairly decent person. He didn't call for the mass murder of white people, but you see this obsession that they have with being accepted by white people. Being accepted by white people, you know, the most important thing in his life was not really doing anything for his people, but to be accepted by whites. Notice he didn't travel to Haiti. Mm-hmm. He didn't travel to Haiti or to Africa to seek racial fellowship with his own people. And he was a tireless fighter for racial integration and forcing white people to accept black people. So I don't know if it's an aberration or not.
Mm-hmm.
You see over and over again throughout the period leading up to the 50s where the blacks are just obsessed with this idea that they're going to force themselves to be accepted by white people. Martin Luther King never published an autobiography, but an autobiography was published by his family, written by a good friend of him. It's called The Autobiography of Martin Luther King. And you pick it up and you read it, and it says this, you know, this is not really an autobiography, but this man knew Dr. King intimately and all this sort of thing. And he goes into King's childhood. I mean, separate and apart from the fraudulent idea that you're going to publish a book as an autobiography that's not really an autobiography. There's always some weird Orwellian twist to everything associated with blacks. And he talks about how he became a civil rights fanatic or advocate or whatever because when he was a child, there was a white child who didn't want to play with him. And he thought it was horrible that this white child didn't want to play with him. And then when he became an adult, he wanted to have dinner with some white people, and the white people didn't want to have dinner with him. And they said, go to your own restaurant and your own people and have dinner. And this was why he became became a civil rights activist. Well, notice he doesn't say, you know, I got beaten up by white children in school.
Mm.
I got, you know, beaten up by white adults when I became an adult. What he says is they didn't want to play with me and they didn't want to have dinner with me. So, by God, we're going to force white people to play with me and have dinner with me. And we're going to call it civil rights. We're going to call it civil rights to force unwilling people to associate with us, even though they can't stand us. Well, it's not civil. It's not a civil right, except insofar it strips white people our civil rights, of our rights of freedom of association, and freedom of contract. There's something weirdly perverse about people who are so completely obsessed with being accepted by outsiders. There's a novel, I think it was written by a black novelist named Ralph Ellison, called The Invisible Man. I've never read it, yes. But I've read enough descriptions of it. And the great evil, the great racial evil he finds in there is not that white people wanted to beat him up and hurt him, but that he was invisible to white people and white people didn't pay attention to him. And all black literature is obsessed with anger and grievance and hatred and viciousness toward white people. And there is something wrong with this race. There is something wrong with these people at a very fundamental level. There is nothing uplifting or ennobling that I have ever been able to find in any of their writing. It's always this seething, festering envy. And I remind remind of history in the aftermath of the Civil War. Lincoln wanted to have blacks repatriated to Africa, and there was stubborn resistance to that. Why do you think we should go back to our own ancestral homeland? Well, during the same period, the latter part of the 1800s, many, many thousands of white people from Europe went to Africa and built farms and railroads and great cities and great civilizations. So at a time, black people have never had any particular interest in going to Africa and making something great. But white people went there and achieved greatness and achieved a great civilization. Okay. There's something wrong with these people.
We're on the last break. We'll be right back.
Way down on the levee in old Alabama, there's Daddy and Mammy, there's Ephraim and Sammy. On a moonlight night, you can find them all while they're waiting. The banjos are syncopating. What's that they're saying? Oh, what's that they're saying? The while they keep playing, I'm humming and swaying. It's the good ship Robert E. Lee has come to carry the cotton away. Watch him shoving along.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Extendivite 7 herb formulation is approved to help maintain cardiovascular health and help lower blood lipid levels in adults. Extendivite is made from hawthorn, garlic, valerian, cayenne, bilberry, ginkgo biloba, and milk thistle. The herbs in Extendivite have been chosen for their ability to help with overall health. Many people have reported improved energy and stamina in just a few months. If you think you could feel just a little bit better, then Extendivite may just be for you. Extendivite is an all-natural supplement. Extendivite is only $69.95 for a 2-month supply. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com. That's HEARTDROP.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and a new app, Koshertified, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
Gangnam Style.
We are back. So we just have a few minutes left. And, you know, let's fast forward to today, where you're getting the most blatantly anti-white rhetoric coming from all directions, from politicians, from, you know, the FBI, from the media, from academia. And What do you make of it? And do you think there's like a good strategy for getting out of this?
Well, I make of it, what I make of it is they're becoming less and less disingenuous about what their true intentions and their true state of mind is. Their true state of mind is the extermination of white people, whether through outright mass murder or simply, race mixing and you know, breeding us out of existence. And I think that's a good thing, because I think it is a good thing that liberals have finally ripped off the mask and shown their true feelings, their true hatred, and their true intentions. The only good white person is a dead white person, to paraphrase an old saying. I think, what do we do about strategy? Well, I've long felt that until and unless a large number of white people achieve the moral and intellectual clarity to really understand what's going on, we're not going to have much chance of any progress. Certainly, colorblind conservatism has done nothing to help people achieve any moral and intellectual clarity. I think Nick Fuentes using the term racial caste system, I don't know if he got it from me on Stormfront Radio or where he got it. You know, frequently independently thinking people come up with the same conclusions, and regardless of where he got it, it really excites me to hear that term used. And I think that's the important thing whites have to understand. We've been relegated to second class citizenship, and that was the whole purpose of the civil rights movement. There's a black conservative named Shelby Steele who wrote a book called White Guilt. It's a very short book, and I strongly recommend it. And he talks about how, you know, the whole purpose of the black, not the whole purpose, but he talked about, you know, blacks don't manufacture computers or automobiles or much else. The black leadership manufactures white guilt. And the function of white guilt is to destroy the will and the ability of white people to resist. And that is a brilliant book, and I strongly recommend that book. And how do we overcome white guilt? We establish a credible white narrative based on real history, and we help white people understand that we have a right to exist, we have separate and distinct racial interests, and we have a right to assert those interests. And if we're denied those rights, the same rights that are exercised by all other races, we are denied equal protection of the law, and we're denied our moral and legal rights. This is a racial war. It is a racial war, and unlike what Rush Limbaugh would have us believe, it's not about conservatism or Judeo-Christianity. It is about the white race and its struggle for racial survival.
Well, Don Advo, thank you so much for joining me, and I look forward to you coming back again.
I look forward to coming back again, Patrick. Hope you get a lot of good comments on this broadcast.
I'm sure I will. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.
As you can plainly see, at night when he's asleep, into his tent he'll creep, and the stars that shine above will light their way to love. He rules this land with sheep, the sheik of Araby.
Ladies and gentlemen, J.R. Moore here. We have a special promotion going on at Republic Broadcasting. This is a fundraiser for Republic Broadcasting involving the Energy Planner. Mail me a postcard. My address is at my website at thelibertyman.com. We pick a postcard every other Thursday. When your postcard is drawn out, you get to buy an Energy Planner for $215 instead of $285, $70 discount. $200 goes to Republic Broadcasting. You also get a 10% discount on my mattress pads. So get those postcards in, put your name, your telephone number, your email address on there, and when your postcard is drawn, you get to get an energy cleaner for $215 instead of $285. Mattress pads, 10% off. Help us out at Republic Broadcasting and help yourself to get an engine cleaner at a deep discount. It's a win-win situation for everybody. We hope you can get these postcards in soon. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.